That was Vava there with Sinking Feeling. And now we are joined by our guest today, Ross Wallace. Welcome to the studio, Ross.
Yeah, g'day. Okay. Thanks for having me.
Ah, no worries. Yeah. And you're coming here from Okiri today?
Yep. Yeah, just, yep. Yeah. Rocking in off the farm.
Yeah. What's been happening today?
What's been happening today? Well, actually, I dropped my son up at Auckland Airport, so I've been up there today. But yeah, got back and just unloaded a couple of ton of calf milk powder on farm and jumped in here.
And where's your boy off to?
He's back to Dunedin, student.
Yes. Okay. So, well, it's exciting for him.
He enjoys it.
And your calf milk, I mean, how many? So I guess. Yeah, well, tell us a little bit about yourself first and then and about the farm and what have you.
Yeah, righto. Our family's been here for a while. Reverend James Wallace, kind of go back to 1836. So he's a missionary here, first European in the town for about 15 years.
So is Wallace, you know, Scottish or English?
English.
English, all right.
Yeah, English, yeah. But we're English, Scottish, Irish, but the
Wallaces, most people are.
Wallaces were English, yeah.
Okay,
So he came here 1836, and as a 21-year-old, and his wife was 19, and they started a mission here and had a family. 1851 was when the homestead was built out at Okiti. The original homestead. My brother's now on and farming the land, so and then they
What timber's that built out of?
That's out of Cody. I mean, it's one of the old villas, but it's quite funny because you go back, those old villas were actually, in the day, were kitset houses. They all came in kitset form. Yeah, and up they went. So we grew up there. My dad was born in the house. We all grew up there, as did the previous generations. And
So what did you say, 18...
So 1851 was when the farm house was built.
How many generations is that now?
So I'm sixth, so my kids are seventh. Right. My grandkids, I've got three grandkids, so they're, eighth.
Far out, man. That's a long way back.
Goes back away, but for the real locals, it's not that far back, probably.
Okay. Oh, well, that's cool, man. And so when did... was it like the very next generation from like being a missionary to being a farmer, do you know?
Yeah, so it was his son who started farming. So Reverend James, he was here for 30 years as a minister. And then his son was the first to start farming and on that property, and that's been handed down the generations. So now my brother farms it. It's all dairy now, so it's a dairy farm. When we were growing up, we were sheep and a bit of dairy. Still remember the old sheep running around the back and getting through holes and fences. Dad pulled, he hated sheep. Kept finding holes and fences and then dairy kind of grew from there. The stories go kind of back to when they were separating milk themselves and into cream cans and the way going down to the piggeries. So there were old piggeries that subsequently not there now because they've blown over.
So the cream cans would have come down to the wharf here, and
I'd imagine so. Dad would tell stories of that
on a horse and cart or whatever, I suppose.
They'd have to bring them out to the front gate, so probably a kilometre down the road, and leave them there, and they'd be picked up from there, and off they went. The old milking by hand in the early days, but I never knew any of that. It was all milking machines. And I hated milking anyway as a kid.
So you're brought up in that environment. Then I don't know, what did you do? Went to school, I guess, in Tuku.
Tuku school. Went through there. Then we went to school in Auckland. Went to Auckland Grammar.
Boarded up there.
Yeah, yeah. My old man went to New Plymouth Boys High School, so I don't know why we didn't go there. But apparently,
geez, that's a ways away.
Yeah. But so we went up to Auckland, and I didn't actually like farming growing up, so I've kind of left it behind and probably followed in James Wallace's footsteps and spent 10 years volunteering in missions and out of Australia and into Southeast Asia. Met my wife, she's Australian, had four kids ended up back here on the farm with Dad, kind of helping out in 2000.
Yeah.
And then I fell in love with the business of farming, that farming is more than just having to get up in the morning, milk cows and be a lackey.
So I
really enjoyed the business of farming and kind of went from there, went back to school and studied to learn what I needed to know for budgeting and cash flows and all that sort of stuff.
So like a business degree or something like that?
Yeah, I was just through the Ag ITO and getting a diploma in agribusiness management.
Right.
Which was really good because I didn't do that great at school. Even though I went to Lincoln for a year straight out of school, but didn't last long.
I did exactly the same thing. Yeah, I had a year's work and then went to Lincoln and I lasted about 2 years and I was like, actually, no, I'm going to go and do some work.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's pretty much my story. Yeah. But it's because I didn't learn that way, being on the farm and learning at the same time was far more practical for me.
Mm.
And so I kind of lapped it up. And mainly because you had to know. It's like, what do I do here, Yeah. I've got to prepare a budget for the bank. How do I do that, And so they're teaching you. And so away you went. And it all started making sense. That kind of made farming a bit more interesting. But, yeah, it's 22 years ago. And since then we've expanded a little bit and started planting an avocado orchard just to see how things see how that goes. But got a neighbour doing it, and he said, "Oh, you won't miss a couple of hectares. Just give it a go." So
why not?
Yeah.
They've been coming along all right.
Yeah, they are actually. Yeah, surprisingly, I know nothing about avocados, so I just did what I was told, and I kind of looked at them, going, "Oh, don't know about these." And the nurserymen were down the other. Couple of weeks ago and said, look, this is the worst they'll probably look because they've been a year on the ground, and he said, no, they're looking real good. So
sweet.
Happy.
And it's important these days, the darn farm, to try and diversify the income a little,
Well, part of it, I think, for us is I'm a bit getting a bit sick of milking cows, and the shoulders are starting to go a bit, and so just looking to retirement and what we could do further on the track, and also just to something that's a bit different, kind of piques the interest again. And
For sure.
But we've got quite a bit of technology on the farm now too. We use halter collars for the cows. We've got automatic calf feeders, stuff like that. So I mean, so some of your listeners, the farming listeners, probably think I don't do much these days with all that. But there
also might be some people who don't even know what halter collars are, so I guess run through those.
Yeah, so they're basically a collar, and they've developed hugely since we first put them on. That's only a year ago, so it's rapidly, technology is rapidly increasing. But basically, it allows you to geo-fence your cows, so you can strip your fences out, and these collars go on, basically the cows stay within a grazing area. It's based on some the collars when they're learning, buzzing, and then sounds. So now, as you're moving the cows, they get a sound either left or right, and it directs them through the gate and off to the cow shed or into a new break. But the greatest benefit of it is taking it's something like 3,000 data points a minute off each cow, so it looks at rumination, grazing, health of the cow, heat, so for breeding purposes and stuff. So it'll tell you when a cow's coming on heat, when she's at her ideal mating period, or whether she's just come off heat. Also, like I said, health. So you can look at your app and see, there are a few cows that have got some issues, so I can pull them out. They've got flashing lights, so you can light them up in the morning and pull them out that way. And it just saves you sitting behind cows, moving them behind, on a bike in the morning and at night. And probably last year the real benefit was with grazing crops, so grazing turnips. You could just have a really long face Which I hate doing with a fence. It's kind of like, can't I stuff it? I'll just do that block where you could just go 0.12 hectares for the 270 cows or whatever they were, and every day you just they just took that exact amount. That was brilliant. Yeah.
And how long have you been growing turnips over there?
So yeah, it was a bit of an on off. I've only had them in probably the last 2 years. We're kind of chicory all the way. So I still do about 10% of the farm in a pure sward of chicory.
Okay.
Just to get through summer. But the year before,
you don't mix it in with the ryegrass and the cloves.
I'm starting to do that now with some of the permanent grass mixes that we're putting in, just with you got to meet your obligations around climate change and that kind of thing, and some of those grasses and species are starting to work their way into the thing. But I love chicory, but you got to get in at the right time. So the season before last, we got in a bit late, had the best strike, but it was just too late. It was November, and we got one graze out of it. So last year we went early again, October, got it in, and it does you well.
All right.
But the turnips were good too, but I find turnips are a little bit hit and miss. You know, the years you want them, that don't seem to grow that well, and the years you don't want, you don't need them, they grow really well. But
right.
I think choosing your paddocks is probably key on that one. So we'll see. Yeah. We're going again this year with turnips.
You do like a bit of maize and what have you as well? Or?
No, I used to do maize. I'm not a great maize grower. I didn't get great yield, so it was probably better bang for buck by buying it in.
Yeah. Okay. And how many cows are you running on the farm?
We're about 270 this year, 270, 275. I've got a few carryovers on there as well. But, yeah, we were running around the 300, but we've kind of dropped it back a bit, and that's on about 108 hectares effective. So it's the stocking rate's not huge. We're once a day all season as well. That helps.
For
but,
sure.
Last year, man, the amount of feed we're bringing in just through the drought was just ridiculous. So we're trying to farm to be a bit more self-sufficient, but when you get hit with droughts, what can you do?
Was last year's drought like worse than the previous couple of years' droughts, do you think?
Oh, yeah, it felt like it, especially when I was...
More of a combination of maybe, low aquifers or whatever, I guess.
Yeah, it was just low, definitely. Although in saying that, we probably had our better chicory production year. I think without that, we would have been stuffed. But also, having the higher payout, it's kind of like, you're kind of driven to keep going. But regardless, if you've got a drought, you've still got to feed your cows. So you've got to spend money on feed, whether you're milking them or not milking them. So figure, we'll do it milking. But it wasn't really until I added up all the feed at the end of the season for our report to Fonterra that, I actually realised, holy moly, we imported a lot of feed. It was it went from about 400 kilos a cow to a ton last year. So this year I've just gone, we've got to take control of some of those costs this year and really try and manage it. So the stocking rate is probably a little bit lower this year. But one thing with halter does help us with our better grazing, because we've pulled a heap of fences out, so you can allocate the exact area for the cows a lot more accurately. So which is really really been helpful. So I've got a spring rotation planner onto the app and just I'm just following that.
Man, it's incredible, the technology like that, isn't it, these days, man?
And what blows me away is how far it's come just in a year. I was screaming at them about stuff this time last year, and man, it's just like, if you look back, you just go, man, this is like the improvements they've made in a short period of time is phenomenal.
And you've been supplying Fonterra ever since they sort of started, or?
Yeah, we have. We don't have too many, haven't had too many options out this way, really. But yeah, we have, and I've...
Was it the New Zealand Dairy Company? Was that operating out
here? New Zealand Dairy Company, and so they obviously, all the cooperatives kind of merged together until you had Kiwi and New Zealand Dairy Group, and then they did the the final merger to create Fonterra. But I mean, the long and short of it is, I think you know, I'm really a supporter of cooperatives, because at the end of the day, you know, cooperatives are owned by us. And as long as we keep the, you know, keep the pressure on the board to make good decisions, which hasn't always happened, but you know, it's in our hands. So we're getting the most value out of it, because we own it. Any company is going to do the same for their shareholders, right? So it's about making money for their shareholders. Well, we're the shareholders, not, you know, an outfit in China or anything else, where a lot of the other companies are. So
And it appears to be paying off, you know, pulling out of various countries, and that, you know, like they had interest in Australia and Chile and those kind of things, and they're pulling back from that now, aren't they, as a company?
Yeah, I think the strategy's changed. I mean, I was on the Fonterra Shareholders Council for 8 years, and it was back in Tao Spearing's time and John Wilson. And I think,
how'd you find that experience?
Oh, it was extremely fascinating. It was amazing to see all the intricacies of you know, how the company worked, and you know, seeing the whole chain, you know, from the farm all the way through to the customer. That was phenomenal, and just seeing, you know, how they deal with a wall of milk every day. They've got milk coming every day. You've got to do something with it. And that's why cooperatives were formed, because farmers could then just focus on producing the milk. And, you know, basically in a cooperative, we employ other people to do the, you know, the marketing, distribution and all that stuff for us. So it was fascinating from that side. The politics of it is interesting to see the politics at work. Understanding the strategy a bit more, you know, back in, like as I mentioned, Tao Spearings, I mean, he got a hard rap when he left, he needed to, but, you know, at the end of the day, the industry is very different now than it was then. Back then, we're on a growth milk curve, you know, there were people ramping up milk production in New Zealand, the farms converting, and you had all this milk, so you had to do something with it. So I don't think, you know, I certainly wouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. I think their strategy early on, they had to do something, and so they did expand, but I think where they came apart was with, you know, the rules and regulations and everything on the industry. They didn't really see the future and that milk, I guess, plateauing early enough. And so that's where it kind of, the wheels fell off a bit. I'm really, you know, I've been really interested to watch the strategy now, which is about focusing more on New Zealand milk and less about, you know, milk pools around the world. And it seems to be paying off at the moment. But, you know, at the end of the day, milk prices. We'll see what they can make on the dividend side of it, and, you know, the profitability.
Yeah. I think the midpoint a couple of weeks ago was 9.30 something, is that right?
Yeah, it dropped slightly, I think. So, 9.30, but that's record.
It's good lurk.
Those are record payouts the last couple of years. Inflation's bitten hard too on the farm, and so, you know, often, you know, I find myself lulled into a bit of a false sense of security when you get payouts like that. You kind of like, oh, you know, you can be a bit looser with your, you know, with your money and kind of, you know, investment and stuff like that. And you get through it and actually go, we actually need to pull the reins in, keep controlling costs, so that these years we can ride the bad ones, which you always do with farming. That's always swings around about.
And I guess, yeah, a lot of other Fonterra suppliers, especially in dairy, man. I mean, the debt level is massive, isn't it? You know.
Oh, we're a bit more aware of that now. Because we've been leasing a block for years since we were on the farm, and just a few years ago we bought the block that we'd been leasing, and I know a little bit about debt now. But no, it's all part and parcel of it, eh?
You got to take risks, you know. And so you're still involved with Fonterra?
Not as a rep. No, I stood down a couple of years ago. It was just during COVID, I think. We kind of came to the end of my tenure there. Decided to let someone else have a go. So I haven't actually been involved much at all. You're all, you know, one day you're right in the midst of it, and the next day it's kind of like. clean cut, and but it's been nice actually, just getting back, more time on farm, and yeah,
free up a bit of space in your brain for other things.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
So your area, it was quite big, wasn't it?
It grew actually while I was in that role. They changed, so I went from 36 wards down to 25.
Right.
So our area ended up being pretty much Raglan to Manukau Heads, and then across.
So it'd be Awhiriwhiri, Onifiroa.
Part of Pukekohe, then down.
Mangatawhiri, those ways, or?
Pass.
yeah, I'm just thinking.
We kind of came down. Yeah. We came down State Highway 1 to kind of Huntley and Huntley West. And then it shot out to Gordonton and then to pretty much Hamilton City and cut through the middle of Hamilton. Well, obviously, there's nothing there in terms of farms and down State Highway 23. Out to Raglan, so yeah.
Right, So, yeah. And that involved you driving around to go meet up farmers all through that area?
Yeah, we had, we'd attend discussion groups and do surveys and do, all sorts of things to try and engage farmers and try and understand what their views were, and it's always the hard thing with representation is trying to get an accurate picture of what people are feeling and thinking. When things are going bad, you usually hear a whole lot. When things are going good, you don't hear so much. But it's all part and parcel of it. And it's trying to weed out is this just a squeaky wheel? Is it the same person? You know, it's like, is that representative of the whole group? And so that's what you've got to figure out.
How'd you find the level of engagement from farmers?
If you had to
make a rough percentage, say, of all the Fonterra suppliers, how many would actually be engaged with you and talking about stuff?
Like I said, it depended if things were good or things were bad. When it was bad, there was high level engagement. When things were good, it was probably less of a level. But in saying that, you can't. I did a rural leadership program down at Lincoln, Kellogg's Rural Leadership Program. I did a paper on that, on farmers' engagement with the Shareholders Council and with Fonterra. And when I was interviewing farmers, there were some farmers that we would say, oh, you're disengaged, you're not engaged with the co-op. But actually, just because they didn't come to a meeting or they didn't call me, some of those guys were more engaged than anyone because they read everything and that's how they wanted to spend their time. I don't have time to jump in the car and drive an hour to one of your meetings, but I'm reading everything. So that was really interesting to me. So you've got to be kind of careful as to what you view or how you measure engagement. Yeah. So that I found that really interesting. But as a whole, farmers are a pretty engaged group of people. Like they'll definitely let you know when things aren't going right, and they don't mince their words, which is quite helpful actually.
You know where you're at, right?
And
I suppose, another thing I want to talk about. I mean, there's a lot of anti-farmer sentiment, especially anti-dairy farmer sentiment. I mean, dealt with in any way sort of through Fonterra at all, or like support programs for cockies who might be feeling like everybody hates me, I'm going to eat some worms or whatever,
I think it's Fonterra has been pretty good through FarmSource in actually engaging and offering support to farmers, but step back from that, the biggest issue, and you talk about dirty dairying, that was probably 15 odd years ago, 20 years ago even, things have come a long way, but it's, as farmers, it's not about, what about them and what about, it's really just, well, just get on and do it. And I think Fonterra farmers have actually done well in that space because they've just gone, right, we need to get on and just head down, bum up, which is kind of a farmer's attitude anyway, and get on with the job at hand. And so, they've fenced waterways, they've done plantings, they've done these things, looking at, looking now at stocking rates, looking at, marginal land and whether it's ideal for this or that, and looking at, and things are just constantly changing, and it is tough. You look at what's required and it's like, oh, man, it's like far out, it seems to be coming from all angles. And, one of the things I would like to see more of is just rather than having this duplication of information that needs to go, just to have one, I've got a survey sitting on my desk at home that I've been getting for years about, you know, it's a farming census survey, you know, and all that information I've filled out for either Fonterra or for the regional council, for the district council, all these things are, you know, it's like, you know, all these groups need them. Why can't we centralise it? And, you know, so, but anyway.
So much paperwork in farming these days.
I know. It's getting, starting to get a bit, I can see why some of the, older guys are kind of like, oh, you know, I've had enough. Leave it to these young fellas to, you know.
It's crazy. I mean, I suppose, it's, you know, it's in every industry, I guess, man. But, yeah, but the paperwork is large. And you know, like every other industry as well, like there's always going to be, I don't know, what, your 5%, 10% of farmers who, you know, maybe aren't doing everything they could or whatever, but like you say, I mean, like, you know, 90-95% of farmers actually are. You know?
Yeah.
And it's not. And what gets me is like, there's a lot of people think, you know, dirty dairying, this and that, but I mean, most farmers you meet actually they care about their land more than anybody else you'd ever meet. You know what I mean? It's not like it's.
Well, it's in our best interest to look after the farm, the land, right? So. The soil, it all starts with the soil. You look after the soil, it's going to grow your grass, it's going to look after your cows, and then your cows are going to look after you. So, or beef or whatever you're grazing. I mean, so at the end of the day, the more we care for it and look after it, the more benefit we're going to get from it. The research and development, that was one of the things, like working with Fonterra and seeing the research and development program down in Palmerston North is just phenomenal, and the research and development that is going into, you know, grasses in New Zealand that will, you know, the new species that are coming through, it's amazing what the future is going to look like in terms of, you know, cows emitting less methane. And for us, you know, if a cow's emitting less methane, it takes a lot of energy to emit methane. So if we, if I can get my cows to emit less methane, that means more milk, which means more productivity to me. So that's how farmers actually look at this. They're not going, oh, I don't care, I just want to emit as much methane as I want. No, we actually want to emit less methane because I know if I do that, I'm going to get more milk in the vat. I'm going to get more money in my back pocket. So that, you know, and that's really, when you care for the land like that, it'll look after you. If you don't, if you're a cowboy out there, you know, farming like a cowboy, you're not going to be, at the end of the day, you're not going to be profitable, because if you don't look after the land, it's not going to look after you.
Exactly, yeah, and a lot of people, you know, and like you say, it's from all directions. It's, you know, from the beehive right through to the media, right through to, you know, various other people, you know, it's all bag the farmers. But interesting on that one, I was just reading the other day that there's a macro algae which they studied, I think it was either in the States or Britain, where if you add it as, I think it's 5% or something of the cow's diet, it reduces methane emissions by like 90%. So there's always innovations like that coming in, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And I know that Fonterra are doing studies on that at the moment.
No, it's really interesting stuff.
Yeah.
And you're also, for the first time, you're going to, as we've been sitting here chatting away, have been people drifting into the town hall here at Raglan Community Radio HQ here on Bow Street, and just next door in the supper room, there's the community board is having a little meeting at 1:30, which you'll be able to get to.
All right.
After this. And you put your hand up for it.
I did, someone talked to me a couple of months ago about it, and I was considering it, and I didn't do anything until the day before, and someone rang up and said, oh man, they don't have enough people, have you thought about it? And I had, and I thought, oh yeah, it's the first time it's been out now, that they've extended the boundaries out to Okiti, and I think part of Ohaotearoa Road, and out Tomato Way and around the mountain. So I thought, hey, it's a good opportunity for someone from the rural area to jump in and have some representation as well. So put my hand up. But at the end of the day, there weren't a short number of people there. We've got more, so there's going to be elections. So.
Well, that's good.
It's all good. Yeah, democracy working, eh?
And like you say, I think it's important there's some rural voice there. Yeah, it must have been weird for you growing up. I mean, like, you're just there, just slightly out of town and not being able to actually, because it's only, this election that you're actually allowed to put your hand up kind of thing if you're outside of the Town boundary or whatever it was, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, it's only been since, 1851, so we've finally got been able to have the family represented. But, I know. It's it is kind of weird because you pay rates and everything, and as a farmer, you kind of go, oh, what am I getting from rates? It's like I'm living on a partially unsealed road with heaps of potholes and stuff. But we come into town, and that's where we enjoy our leisure time, and we enjoy your footpaths in town here, and the walks around the beach, and stuff. So it's good to be able to get involved and maybe put a little bit of a different perspective. Should I be elected on the community board?
Amen. And you bring that representative experience from Fonterra, and you've been on the board of trustees at the school as well, I hear.
Yeah, so I was a board of trustees at Tiuku School when my kids were there.
A little while ago?
Going back a while now, but I think, that representative role on Fonterra for 8 years has been really helpful in terms of understanding the difference between representation and governance, and also the opportunities that gave me to do Kellogg's Rural Leadership Program at Lincoln University. I've done the governance development program with Massey and Fonterra. I'm on a board of Tier Fund New Zealand and on a board of Flame Cambodia, which is they're both non-profits, international NGOs. And we
I don't think I've heard of either of those, to be honest.
Yeah, well, Tier Fund's a global NGO, and my particularly why I got involved was around the dairy side of it. So we're I've been offering services into Sri Lanka and dairy development there, and they were in a civil war for 30 years, and so really devastated, and milk's a big part of their culture, and we're using dairy to rebuild communities there, just teaching them that, hey, your couple of cows in the backyard, if you just do a few things differently, you can actually turn that into an income for your family. And so we've been able to, or Tier Fund and our partner that works over there, we've been able to lift families that join the program over the poverty line. And there's been about 3,500 farmers so far.
Well, man, that must be incredibly rewarding work.
Yeah, it is. It is. Really is. Yeah.
Good on you, man. I guess we ought to wrap it up. I'm going to run out of time. There's Harry's coming in half an hour or so I've got to do the editing and what have you. Send it off to Free FM, our friends over there.
All good.
Going out through the Waikato. Thanks very much for coming in, Ross.
Yeah, no, thanks.
It's nice to meet you, and I'm sure we'll have you back on at some stage, and good luck with the community board mahi.